Welcome to Identity, a series brought to you by ID Magazine. Join me, Osman Ahmed, ID's Fashion Features Director, as I explore the enduring legacy of some of the last four decades' most influential subcultures and the guiding figures within them. This season, we're taking a different tack, with each episode focusing on an artist whose life and work are anchored in subculture. Today I'm joined by legend, artist, and radical icon, Cozy Fanny Tutti.
From a very, very young age, I kind of felt separate. It was interesting all of a sudden having people want to put things on the wall that weren't allowed there 35 years ago. You know, life is art, art is life. That was a Coombe thing as well. You know, everything is valid. I don't call it bravery. It's more determination and not to just carry on, but to not allow people to hold you back and hold you down and silence you.
Born Christine Carol Newby in 1951, the daughter of a fireman and a wages clerk from Hull's Bilton Grange Council estate, Cozy Fanny Tutti, as she is now known, took her name from Mozart's famous opera, which translates as, "That's what all women do." "My life is my art is my life," she has famously said, refusing to define her practice by discipline. Instead, her work has spanned music, performance, costume, photography, collage, forging connections between different creative realms. And often it has placed herself at its centre, provoking in the process. Sex has been a part of Cozy's work since the beginning, most notably in 1976 when she and Coombe staged a now infamous exhibition at the ICA in London titled Prostitution. The poster featured magazine spreads from Tutti's two-year foray into the porn industry as part of her arts practice, along with a five-foot dildo and a Perspex box containing her used tampons, which were crawling with maggots. At the time, the exhibition was debated in Parliament, where a Conservative MP claimed that she was the wrecker of civilization, and as a result of the coverage, Tutti's mother never spoke to her again. She worked as part of countercultural anti-consumerist art collectives for the first two decades of her career, but it wasn't until the 1990s that her work was celebrated by the mainstream, acquired by institutions and displayed alongside artworks by the likes of Yoko Ono, Marina Abramović and Gilbert and George. Right now, some of her works are on display as part of Tate Britain's Women in Revolt exhibition. We sat down to discuss an illustrious life spent in the counterculture and the radical ideas that still sit at the beating heart of her work. Here she is, Cozy Fanny Tutti.
I wanted to start at the beginning. You lived in Hull for the first 20 or so years of your life. What was it like growing up there? What was Hull like at that time? And what was your upbringing like?
I lived on a council estate, one of the new estates that were built to house people after the Second World War, because 80% of the housing had been destroyed during the war. And my father had been in the Navy fighting. And so I was with a lot of other children from all different backgrounds and all different religions as well, which for me, now looking back, I think was a great thing. Because we weren't kind of pulled into one kind of type of person or job or anything like that. So there were professionals as well as factory workers, dockers, that kind of thing.
Was there a key moment in the journey to you discovering your sense of identity and perhaps creating art in relation to that?
I don't know. I think... I've been asked this quite a few times, and when I wrote my book, I sort of, it made me kind of think about it more, about how did I become who I was, why did I end up here, you know, or where did I end up anywhere in Hull even. But I think it was from a very, very young age, I kind of felt separate to a lot of my friends. I got on really well with them. I had loads of friends. I had a great childhood. But there was this kind of underlying feeling that I wasn't going to end up where they were. For some, I didn't know where I was going to end up, but I just sort of felt something out there, and I don't quite know what it is, but I'll enjoy myself doing things and getting out there, and I'll discover it if it comes along, you know.
And at that time, because this would have, you would have been a teenager in the 60s.
Yeah.
Which I suppose when we kind of look back, or when I do anyway, at the 60s in kind of Britain, you know, this, it seems that there's so much going on, so many new ideas, so much kind of rebellion and revolution. What were you seeing at that time that was kind of influencing you, or making you think in a different way, or making you see things in a different way?
The music was the biggest thing. Mm. Because even before my teens, there was like pirate radio. So you got to listen to different kinds of music than the BBC put on the TV, pop music kind of stuff. And even with, I mean, it seems quite tame now to think of the Beatles back then. But when they came through and then they sort of like went off to on a different tangent, that kind of made you think, there isn't just this. You can actually explore other avenues and do stuff with your life. Mm. So, there were all different factors involved with it, to be honest, because there was Dylan and there was poetry and there was all kinds of bands going around at the time. And like I've said before, and there were female vocalists coming into, there were protest songs like Joan Baez, stuff like that. A lot of it was from America for me. I got to hear it, and I think the biggest thing with the revolution was the protest against the norm. That's what did it for me.
Mm.
And I thought, yeah, you're right. I kind of really understood what they were saying, that, you know, life doesn't have to be like this. We don't have to treat each other the way we do. We don't have to hurt one another.
Mm.
And the way to do that from these people was get the message across with music, poetry, the creative arts.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I think that's where I'm going to head.
You didn't go to art school or art college, but you did end up becoming an artist. Mm. How did that happen, and when did you start creating more formal work?
Well, I don't think my work has ever been formal. That's been part of my trouble, if you want to call it trouble. I just wanted to get on and do what I want to do, and I'm still like that now. I work independently. Yeah, my work has not been formal, really. I think it's become formal, as in now it's shown in institutions and galleries and exhibitions, but it's a funny one, because all those years ago, nobody wanted it. You know, there was a lot of protest about it. So, but I just carried on.
It must have taken a lot of conviction and bravery to continue believing in yourself that you could do it and to continue creating.
I don't call it bravery. It's more determination, and not to just carry on, but to not allow people to hold you back and hold you down and silence you. And I don't ever remember thinking that, because people say like it's a political act. I don't remember thinking of it like that. I was so focused on doing what I wanted to do and living a life that made me feel good about myself, good about what I did, and fulfilled. And it's always been the same.
Was there a particular experience early on in your life that had a profound impact on the work that you wanted to create?
I don't think so. I think it was cumulative. Everything fed into me, and that's where it came from, rather than I had some kind of epiphany from someone else's work.
Mm.
It was a mixture of everything, and I think that's why I do music and visual arts and writing. Because I don't want to limit myself in any way. If I've got something to do, I will look how to express myself in any medium.
Mm. That's also, you know, something about you that is incredible, is that you have worked with so many different disciplines and medium: collage, photography, costumes, music, performance, zines. You know, it feels like throughout your work and the body of the work, you've forged kind of connections between different creative realms. But was that unusual at the time that you were doing that, to kind of work with so many different media and disciplines?
It was very unusual in Hull. Even for a woman to come out on the street dressed differently to anyone else, you know, was very difficult and usually attracted violent attention and verbal abuse. And it still did when I moved to London, to be honest, in certain situations. But no, it's just one of my attitudes to life is that is to live life, I know it's a real cliche, to the full, if you like. I don't kind of limit myself in any way. The information all goes in and kind of assimilated in at different speeds, I suppose. Because even going back, if I think about what I'm doing now, I go back a few years and I look and I think, wow, that was 10 years ago.
I'd love to have a visual of it, but you said kind of stepping out of the door, you know, in Hull in those early days in London, getting a lot of kind of flack for the way that you were dressed. Can you describe how you were dressed at that time and how you were kind of navigating the world? What would people see when they saw you?
I had these blue satin shorts on. Well, they were called hot pants back then because they were very, very short. And I had blue tights on. And I had stitched these red sequin stars all over them. And I had these metallic blue high platformed shoes on and a little black velvet jacket. And nowadays, that's nothing. Mm-hmm. But in Hull, when everyone was dressed in beige and brown and, you know, that kind of thing and just very sensible clothes, I heard someone turn around. I heard someone as I walked past, swear at me and say, you know, and sort of shouldered me a bit as I went across. Well, back then I was kind of used to not letting that pass. I immediately turned round to, you know, confront them, and there was going to be a fight in the middle of the crossing there until someone pulled them off. And it was skinhead girlfriends more than the skinhead guys used to confront me, and they were really, really vicious. They used to have those metal combs and they used to sharpen the long end of it for like a knife then. And even the blades of it, you know, it was pretty violent, but we knew skinheads as well. Mm. As Coombe, when we used to do things, we tended to befriend and be befriended by these sort of subgroups within the city, because we were all kind of struggling against the same thing, you know.
You mentioned that, you know, sometimes it would be the girlfriends or women that kind of there would be a more visceral or violent reaction from. Why do you think that is?
I've no idea. I don't know whether maybe they had to live up to being what skinheads are that were violent back then, especially the Hull ones. I can only speak for them because they were like dressed like Clockwork Orange, you know, they'd taken that as an example of how to be. So you know where that was coming from immediately. But then the guy that was the head of the skinheads there, they used to come around the house and sit and talk with us for hours. So that was befriending and being sort of alternative as a support group to one another, you know.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, one of the big themes throughout this podcast is the idea of subculture, not just history, but also now. But for you, what defines subculture?
For me, I think subcultures are cultures within, almost within a counterculture, because they already, you know, don't really feel part of the mainstream. Mm. Then they look for some kind of identity that, you know, sets them apart, which with skinheads is the dress, with goths is the dress. And it can go on like that. That's how I see it, is that they're kind of rebelling in their own way against culture and counterculture. Mm. Because I think quite a lot of subcultures do adhere to some mainstream values. Mm. Whereas countercultures are counter to that, literally, you know, which is what we were. And I still am.
I feel like there's this human need to be a part of a tribe in some way. Mm. And that's really something that we see with so many subcultures is this idea of a sense of belonging. But then at the same time, there is this need for individuality and individualism. How did that balance kind of manifest for you?
Well, I always see it that the subcultures give you... they're like a kind of support network for the fact that you don't feel like you fit in elsewhere, but you can fit in here, and that for me I think is quite important, because you can have support for being not quite right if you, according to normal society, you know, there's something not right about you, which is really offensive. And then you find someone else. But these groups, like you said, tribes are really important. I think it's innate in us all that we have to feel that we fit together. That's how we survive. Mm. So when society worldwide at the moment is so fractured, I think it's quite a difficult time for a lot of people to find where they feel comfortable.
Mm.
Because even within subcultures now, you get like disagreements and, you know, think, oh, we'll have to sort of find another subculture that believes in this. This is what happened with feminism back in the 70s.
I really enjoyed seeing your work in the exhibition that's currently on at Tate Britain, Women Revolt. And actually, that was something that I kind of really took away from that exhibition, which looks at certainly that time period of the 70s and early 80s, all the different kind of women-led groups that were happening in Britain, as well as artists and artworks that were being made, that really spoke to a shared sense of fighting back and spotlighting women's issues.
Yeah, it was the same voice, but expressed differently by different groups.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we need now, a common voice. Express it how you wish, but don't forget it. It's for everybody.
At that time, was there a sense that that was going on? You know, when you were kind of in it or creating that work, was there a sense that there was this wider movement happening?
Yeah, I felt that there was definitely kind of two levels. There was the mainstream, and then there was the counterculture, and the counterculture consisted of subcultures and different things going on. But the aim for the counterculture and subcultures was the same.
Mm.
It was acting against the mainstream.
Now, earlier you mentioned Coombe. I need to ask you about this because, you know, for our listeners who may not be so familiar, Coombe was an art collective that you were part of.
Mm.
I believe 1969 to 1976, and it was a very important part of your life and your career, and you did some very interesting, provocative work as part of it, which I'll come back to. But can you tell me a bit about how Coombe formed and what the kind of driving force was behind the work you were creating at that time?
Coombe, it was gradually formed. The word was around for years. But then when my then partner, Genesis Purridge, was at university in Hull and we met, and then I moved in with him, and then we moved to this old building down Prince Street in Hull. That's when it became fully, not fully formed as a collective, but as an actual working art group.
Mm.
And people would come and take part in whatever we did, either street events or music, anything really. So, but it was free for anyone. You didn't have to, I mean, there was no art college degree necessary. You could, you know, just express yourself how you wanted. It was freedom of expression completely, and to be yourself. And that was what was important. And what I was talking about before is, you know, life is art is life. That was a Coombe thing as well. You know, everything is valid. So we would have all kinds of people helping out, you know, and taking part in our activities. So, and then when we moved to London, it started changing just before we left Hull. Our focus was very different then. It became kind of more focused on the self rather than going out and doing performative, colourful, disruptive events in the streets. And that was because so much had happened between 70 to 73, I think was when we moved to London, where there was male art going on. So we'd been in touch with people around the world. It's very difficult now because people say, well, yeah, got the internet for that. But we didn't have that then.
Mm.
We didn't even have a telephone for a long, long time. Couldn't afford it, you know. So male art was our fantastic little network of meeting other artists that were like-minded. And so that kind of like buoys you up and encourages you. Yeah, you know, I've not been wrong all these years. There's other people out there. Mm. And that was what we were mainly saying to people, you know, we're not on our own. Mm. Counterculture, subculture, it's all valid. It's good. And don't feel guilty about it. There's nothing wrong with it. at least then at the end of it, you feel that you're good enough and fulfilled enough to go on to the life that you want to lead. Mm. You don't have to be in it forever kind of thing. I just happen to be one of the people that do.
Tell me a bit about how that kind of network, that male art network, actually works. I think so many people who have grown up with kind of digital connection would be so intrigued.
Well, it was physical letters, ink, paint, anything on paper, card, even a brick was put through the post. Mm. It was a communication network. The only way you could do it was through the postal system. And you would get little artworks. It was basically sending artworks to each other. Mm. And you would send things that you knew these people were into, so, or materials that they used that you didn't particularly use in your work. You'd find some, or you'd send them a little package so that they could create art as well in their own way, their own sort of like style. Mm. And then they would reciprocate and send you things. I knew you would love this. Mm. And it was beautiful movement, really was.
And am I right in thinking that it was around this time that you kind of got your name, Così fan tutti, which of course is borrowed from the Mozart opera. Can you tell me a bit about the story of how that came about?
Yeah, it was through male art. a male artist friend of mine, Robin Klasnick, he sent me a postcard with a play on my name, Così fan tutti, and that's where it came from. Mm. And I just loved it because at that point I was beginning to work with nude magazine materials as well. So that was like, I really liked the tutti frutti bit of it and the fanny bit of it. So it kind of worked, the cozy bit. Yeah. And he was fantastic because he actually got us a studio in Martello Street. It was his studio before it was ours. So he instigated a lot. I moved to London and my name. So thank you, Robin.
There's so many things that I have to ask you, but this kind of period kind of gives way to 1976, the now revolutionary and seminal exhibition that you did at the ICA, Prostitution, which, just to give context to our listeners, was so provocative that it was debated in Parliament and you were described as a wrecker of civilization. You know, in the exhibition, there were kind of 5-foot dildos and poster itself has you kind of topless, which, to just give context, nowadays, if you were to put that on Instagram, it would get taken down and censored because you're not allowed to show a woman's breasts. But can you tell me a bit about, firstly, how this exhibition kind of came about and how you began to approach it and decide what you wanted to put out there?
I'd started using sex magazines in my collages and sending them as male art. And that's when the idea came that I thought, well, if I actually go and do the modelling for these magazines and then I can start collaging myself into these different works. Mm. And I was quite fascinated by it. Even just looking at the magazines, it was a world that, especially as a woman in Hull, you should never even be looking at them, never mind thinking of working to go in one. And my sexuality was also really burgeoning at that point, and I was open to new experiences, and this was just like, well, yeah, I could go and do that, see what it's like at least, and not be a hypocrite in using the images of the women that were doing it in my work. And I started doing nude modelling and for porn magazines and porn films as well, because it was just like, my next projects in exploring myself, my sexuality, my experience of life, and getting these images for my work. Mm. So I was auditioning. I did it the way that all girls do it. I signed up with a model agency that I was told also did this kind of work. Mm. So I went to auditions, just like everyone else, and went and did the photographic sessions. I had my portfolio I'd take round. So all the time looking for when I was published so that I could get literally the work that I'd been wanting to use. And they were extracted as actions, art actions of my going and doing these modelling sessions. We framed them. I think there was 41 at that point. And they weren't allowed to be hung on the wall. They had to be put in boxes at the back.
Yes.
The ICA instigated a membership system so that they could legally get around the problem so that people could view them. You had to be a member and you had to pay a fee.
But I mean, there's a couple of things there because, you know, in putting yourself in the work, living it, creating work around that, you know, it's interesting to see that you kind of had made all of the costumes that you're wearing in the self-portraiture. There's so many different elements at play. Every detail is kind of considered. I love the idea of what your name means. That's what women do.
I mean, there were the used tampons as well in the ICA. Oddly enough, they didn't get shunted into the back room with the magazines. I'm still trying to figure out why. I didn't see anything wrong in it. I didn't see anything wrong in the magazines until it was pointed out to me that you shouldn't show them. They shouldn't be on the wall of an art gallery. But yeah, the mundane, whenever I did art actions, it included items that were my everyday.
The response obviously was outrage, let's say, across kind of political spheres, but also amongst the public. I was interested to kind of discover that, you know, the clippings of what was being said in newspapers, that you were then kind of framing them and adding it to the exhibition daily. So the kind of provocation and the response became a part of the exhibition, kind of showing that. I wonder how important is it for your art to shock, to provoke, and to kind of put people's backs up?
It isn't. It's just self-expression, and if it happens to sort of shock people, that's just a byproduct of what I've done. That's not my intention. My art is basically it's not prescriptive. I just do it. When like you mentioned music, I don't go in the studio having written a score for something or even particularly any ideas. I might have a sound in my head. But it's all like going with the flow completely through life, whether it's my work or anything. But like you said, putting the press cuttings on the wall, especially that's where the mainstream and the counterculture totally clashed and it was there on display, you know. And I think that was great, you know. It was basically put on the wall so that people could then see how we were perceived. And how wrong it was as well, because you'd read it and you realise a lot of it was just lies. So that was interesting for me as well, the perception of the mainstream and how they present you to the public through lies and sensationalism.
Yeah. There is a sense that even now that exhibition is more shocking today than it might have been at the time. Why is it that today it still kind of has the power to shock when all it was kind of discussions of female pleasure, the female body, you know, sex work as art practice, kind of showing that from a personal perspective? Why does that feel more radical today than perhaps it did back then?
I really don't know. Someone else would have to answer that question. I have no idea, because porn is all over the internet now. You know, although like you say on Instagram, you can't show certain things.
Yeah.
People just go elsewhere. Why? It seems more shocking, that exhibition now. I'm still trying to figure out why. It's kind of a worry in a lot of ways, because you have freedom now. You seem to have perceived freedom now, but then all of a sudden things get closed down and really quick, you know, like especially with the internet. You just step out of line with one wrong word and that's it. You know, your voice is silenced. Yeah, so subcultures, I think, are really important again, don't you?
Absolutely.
In a different form, possibly, that doesn't rely on the internet completely.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about what is happening now. I think that amongst a young generation who have spent their whole lives living through devices and digital technology, there is a kind of sense of wanting to switch off or searching for something in person, in real life, you know, and not having to document everything. Mm. The pendulum always swings, doesn't it? It's always, you want to go in the opposite direction to the thing that you're kind of being forced to do.
I think the problem is, like you and you said, when people explore things now, they tend to document it on their phone or whatever, and it goes straight up or what, you know. Yeah. It seems that the documenting of it takes precedence over the emotional and physical experience. Mm. It's more important to do that than experience it yourself and assimilate that in some way. And it's kind of like bypassing the purpose of exploring yourself within the world, I think. It's a strange thing. The human instinct seems to have changed from interaction with one another to interaction with your phone and the internet, which is sad.
Yeah. As with some of your other work that we've discussed, you know, a lot of your music is something that sometimes feels quite impenetrable, at times even disturbing, which I know was kind of the imagery was sometimes disturbing that was presented in your live performances as part of as throbbing gristles. But can you tell me a bit about what you're interested in with music and with sounds and this medium?
I think it's sound rather than music and tunes and hooks and things like that. And there are times when you kind of like to play with that formula, which is like we did with TG and Hot on the Heels of Love, that kind of thing. Oh, yeah, let's do a kind of disco song, but TG style, you know. So there are moments like that where you play with things. But ultimately, my approach when I go to make music is to, it has to be emotionally impactful and even physically impactful at times. The sound has to represent the feelings that I've literally had while I'm making the sound, and then build on that so that it gets to the point where you've experienced something emotionally through sound. That's how I work with it. And the lyrics have to do the same kind of thing. So they're not necessarily telling a story, but they're talking about an emotion that's linked to a story. Mm. So they will be kind of disjointed in a way and be put with the music to enhance the whole feeling.
Mm. It also had an effect on several other artists, and Nine Inch Nails, and, you know, so many artists that came after that with this, what then became known as the industrial music genre, I feel like had a profound influence by your work, your music work. What was it like seeing it kind of develop into a genre of its own, and seeing other artists kind of be inspired by what you were creating?
We'd moved on by then, so it wasn't that important. Yeah, we'd started doing different music. I never kind of get stuck in one style, because I've explored it, and then I think, it'd be nice to do something different.
Yeah,
it's a bit like and with art as well, where artists, they get a successful style and they stick with it, and that's how they make their money. I guess I'm not money orientated. So, I had people say to me, you know, with the Chris and Cozy stuff, you could make a fortune. Look, they're doing your kind of sequences and all that on Top of the Pops or whatever. And I said, well, we're doing something different now. I'm not interested in that kind of thing.
Right. Which I think is also something that I really wanted to ask you, because, okay, so in the 1990s, I think your work is starting to be viewed in a different way and certainly becoming revered or critically acclaimed by institutions and the mainstream, let's say. It begins being acquired through galleries and museums and displayed alongside other artists such as Yoko Ono, Marina Abramovich, Gilbert and George, to name a few. What was it like having that, if not late, then perhaps delayed kind of critical acclaim and acceptance by the mainstream? I know that you're going to say that you don't care about that, that you didn't make the work thinking of that. But I don't know. I'm just so curious to know what it was like going through that.
Well, yeah, it was interesting all of a sudden having people want to put things on the wall that weren't allowed there 35 years ago.
Yeah.
For me, I did have a problem with it when requests came through for them to be displayed in feminist exhibitions.
Mm.
Because that's not why I did it. It wasn't about feminism back then. I mean, feminism to me, it's such a loaded word. But for me, it's about self-expression. And that becomes, if you like, feminism. And that's what was explained to me about one of the first exhibitions I was in, that this was about, yeah, there were women in it and it was about feminism, but it was about artists, not necessarily women.
Mm.
That's okay, because for me, these women are artists. You can label them how you like, but nothing would have stopped them doing this, whether they were labeled feminists or not. After it was explained to me, I didn't have a problem with it because I understood completely where they were going with this and the necessity to sort of frame it in some way.
Mm.
But my work wasn't changed in any way to be presented. It was presented exactly how I would have wanted it at the ICA. So that's great. But I had the advantage of also displaying documentation of how I got the work, letters from the magazine editors, that kind of thing, which was even more interesting in a way. It was put completely in context with my practice at the time of that project.
Because I think it's also at this time that contemporary art, let's say, becomes incredibly commercialized. Money becomes a very, very big part of an artist's trajectory. You said earlier that you're not interested in money, but I think no one in the world can deny that money has the power to destruct, transform, you know, your life. What was your relationship to money at this time when you were starting to be collected? And I don't know, was there a part of you that wanted to reject it? Could you use it to move forward?
That's always a difficult question, because I had people asking that about when our music is placed in film and things like that. It's curious when that happens, because you've spent your whole life not focusing on that. You're not producing these works for monetary reasons, other than it'll give you enough money to carry on doing what you want to do. That's how I look at it. And if the works that I did all those years ago give me the opportunity to carry on working and start new projects, then the purpose of those works has changed in some way, but it's also been an added thing for the whole project. Suddenly it becomes bigger. And it's actually helped me continue doing what I want to do. That's how I look at it. And the fact that it also has value to other people, and it's safe. It's not going to be destroyed. It's safe as an example of what you can do if you want to do it. And if it inspires people, then that's how I see. Only thing I think about my work. They say, how do you think about it? And I think, biggest compliment is ever is you've inspired me and I've done this and that, which I get a lot of letters and emails about, things like that. And that's quite humbling in a way.
Yeah. This is the thing, I think a whole new generation who have such an interest in what it means to live a radical life, but also what it means to be countercultural and rage against the machine and protest and be an activist. For them, you are a hero. But what I find really interesting is when I look at the state of art and activism today, there is, I think, amongst the younger generation, a desire to be commercially successful, a desire to exist within the mainstream of, you know, this idea that is the only way that you can affect change, that you have to be kind of a brand, a product, and that's somehow empowering. And I'm curious to know what you think about that. What do you make of kind of, I suppose, a new generation for whom the lines between mainstream and counterculture are very, very blurry?
Well, I think that you have to always bear in mind that if you aim for that kind of success, in inverted commas, the people that can give you that success are driven by money. Mm. And that's just the aim of it, mm. you know. So you're literally buying into that attitude towards your work.
Mm.
And I think that affects the work itself. The motivation is suspect to me. Mm. Even if you play around with that, I think it's still suspect because the people in charge have been playing this game for a long, long time. They know how to do it. They know how to destroy you as well. Mm. So, and you're not going to last forever, you know. And money is not, yeah, it's certainly helpful, especially now when people are in dire straits with money. But it's that whole thing, isn't it, of selling your soul. And how do you live with yourself afterwards?
Mm.
I can live with myself because, you know, that's not been my motivation. And if I have a question mark come up, then usually that's a signal that I shouldn't do it.
When you look at kind of what's going on in the world today, and again, this new generation, is there anything or anyone who particularly inspires you, who makes you feel proud, or perhaps someone who's kind of looking to your work and also creating interesting work?
I couldn't name one person or even two or three because everything changes and I get people contacting me and I either go, oh, that's amazing, or that's interesting, which is on the way to being amazing, if you like, which is me as well. It's not just people that write to me. I have that attitude to my own work as well. You know, it's interesting, but it's not quite going where I want it to go. Mm. I'll set aside, do something else, or that's played its part in me actually getting something fantastic. So I don't look to other people like that. I respect people more than more than that.
And as you've said, you know, your art is your life, your life is your art. What is your life at the moment?
Well, at the moment, there's a few things that are, well, three or four things happening all at one time. Usually that's quite usual for me. But it's good because it feeds different aspects of my work. I've started recording my next solo album. So I'm interested at the moment in, because I have a new instrument and I'm not going to tell you what it is. So I'm really interested in exploring that because I've never heard sounds like that generates before. So that's what I'm really interested in at the moment, making music. But I've also started looking at the Art Sex Music film again. So that's going on in parallel. And then there's art as well that's happening. So yeah, so everything, music, film and art, yeah.
Well, Kezie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for the good questions, actually.
My absolute pleasure. It's an honour.
Thank you again to Kezie for sharing her stories with us this week and to the team who were instrumental in bringing Identity to life. My co-host Mahoro Seward, researcher Ailey Duffy, producer Amelia Phillips, and the audio production team Robin Lieburn and Simon Williams at Podmasters. Oh, and thank you for listening. Join us next week when I'll be speaking to London nightlife legend and former Boombox host James Jeanette Maine.